Welcome to the new theater at Eureka High School. Let me explain why we're in here so that everybody is aware. Not that it's a big deal. It's just a different place, right? By the way, I feel really close to you guys up here. It's kind of a good feeling. Usually I can't even see you. So, hi. They had a problem with the electrical that deals with the heating and cooling. And it's about 98 degrees in there. It's hot in here, but it's a lot hotter in there. And so said, you know, they were very gracious to us. They thought they were going to have somebody come in and get it fixed, and they just didn't get it done this week, and so they just moved us in here, hopefully just for today. We'll see what happens, but they told me they thought they would get to it early this week and get it done. So hopefully we'll be back to our normal place. This is kind of nice, but they have a lot of, you know, it's a great place, and they're, you know, they don't want us to have coffee in here, and we don't, those of you who want coffee, we won't want you to have coffee because we know you'll be grumpy if you don't, and so we want to make sure that that's a good thing. We've been talking about marriage. Everybody loves marriage. It's kind of been our topic. And I had a friend send this to me. I thought it was kind of funny. You've probably seen some of these in email stuff or on the internet. But these are questions that were asked to kids about relationships. And so I thought some of these were pretty funny. They asked, how do you decide who to marry? And Alan, who's age 10, says, you find somebody who likes the same stuff. Like, if you like sports, she should like it that you like sports, and she should keep the chips and dip coming. Kristen, who's age 10, says, no person really decides before they grow up who they're going to marry. God decides it all way before, and you find out later who you're stuck with. What is the right age to get married? Camille said, 23 is the best age because you know that person forever by then. How can a stranger tell if you were married? I like this. Derek, who's age 8, his answer to that was this. You might have to guess based on whether they seem to be yelling at the same kids. What do most people do on a date? Lynette, age 8, said this. Dates are for having fun, and people should use them to get to know each other. Even boys have something to say if you listen long enough. Martin, age 10, answered, on the first date, they just tell each other lies, and that usually gets them interested enough to go on a second date. What would you do on a first date that was turning sour? Craig, age 9, said, I'd run home and play dead. The next day, I would call the newspapers and make sure they wrote about me in all the dead columns. Hold on, I threw my other sheets over here, because there were some funny ones in this one, too. Let's see. When is it okay to marry someone? When they're rich. Pam, age 7, answered that. Kurt, age 7, says, the law says you have to be 18, so I wouldn't want to mess with that. And Howard, age 8, now this is good. The rule goes like this. If you kiss someone, then you should marry them and have kids with them. It's the right thing to do. Is it better to be single or married? Anita, age 9, said this, it's better for girls to be single, but not for boys. Boys need someone to clean up after them. How would the world be different if people didn't get married? Kevin, age 8, said this, there sure would be a lot of kids to explain, wouldn't there? How would you make a marriage work? Ricky, age 9, said, tell your wife that she looks pretty, even if she looks like a truck. You know, kids got it pretty well. They got to kind of figure it out. We've spent the last several weeks, as we're talking about marriage, just kind of walking through what I believe the Bible lays out as God's design for marriage. I really believe God's design for marriage works. That it's a covenant relationship. Two people who say, listen, I am going on a journey, and that journey is toward Jesus. I'm going to give my life for him. I'm going to serve him. I'm going to trust him. And that I'm going to go on that journey with another person. One other person, we're going to go on this journey in a covenant relationship together. And in that covenant that God has created us with roles, and when we find our place in our relationship, it's never going to look the same for two people, but in our relationship is I figure out how I fit in this relationship in my role. As I understand the biblical call for a husband to lead, to be the head of the home, and the wife to be the heart of the home, to submit to his leadership and to support. As I find my place inside those roles and fulfill them, I'm going to find contentment, I'm going to find peace, and life is going to work. I heard somebody compare it like this, that the husband is the head of the home and the wife is the heart of the home. The head tells the heart to work, but if the heart doesn't pump blood to the brain, to the head can't function either. And I like that. There's a commonality, a fitting coming together that is what marriage is all about. Well, this morning and for the next several weeks, we're going to kind of try to take the things that we've said, and now we're going to start applying them to some of the struggles and some of the good things about marriage. Next week, Jim Breeden, who attends here, who works with our association, he's kind of involved in doing missions and all that, great guy, is actually going to preach, and he's going to be talking about finances in marriage. And so I really need to attend that, even though I really don't want to. But he's going to help challenge us on what it looks like when a husband and wife who love Jesus really figure out what it means to be stewards and to love God with our possessions and how that looks in marriage and some things like that. And I'm excited about that. And then July 1st and July 8th, okay, we're going to be talking about sex. Can't believe somebody's actually going to do that in church. And I can't believe that somebody's going to be me, you know, but it's going to be crazy. The first week is going to be pretty level-headed and pretty straightforward and not very embarrassing. The second week, and I'm just kind of giving you a heads up, our youth are at World Changers, which is probably a good thing, okay? On July 8th, I know that you guys will need to get the, you know, make sure they get a copy or listen online to the deal. On July 8th, we're really going to get down. Hey, here's what I've found. I found that the Bible is a lot more candid than we really want to be about this issue. It's actually pretty much a PG-13, maybe even worse book sometimes. And we've kind of made sexuality something we're almost afraid to talk about, but the Bible isn't. And the Bible's got some, it's a great handbook on how to have a great relationship in that area as a couple. And so we're going to talk about that and pretty candidly on July 8th. So just be aware of that. Pray very hard. I love visitors. Love visitors. But I'm really a little nervous about what happens if a family shows up with two 13-year-olds on that day. I'm not sure what we're going to do because our youth will be gone, and I don't know. We'll figure it out, though. But that's going to be, I think it's going to be a really good thing, though. And so I hope you'll be here for those. And then the last week of the series, we're going to really talk about living the fairy tale and how you can do it for the long haul and make it last and make it work and all that kind of stuff. But this morning, we're going to be talking about three specific issues, and those issues are forgiveness, communication and conflict, and, you know, just kind of dealing with setting boundaries and why that's important in marriage. And we're going to be talking, I've got a couple plants up here, and they're going to help me kind of walk through this and kind of give you a visual, I hope, of what I hope your marriage will become. My guess is when you're done, you'll kind of realize that you're between these two plants somewhere, but we'll give you some positive things. But as I kind of set that up, I want to let you know that don't hear this morning as a formula. Marriage should drive us back to Jesus and to the gospel. It should help us understand our utter need for Christ, because the things that I'm going to ask you to do this morning, you can't. You cannot do the things I'm going to ask you to do. It's impossible to live in marriage. I mean, you know, there's no such thing as a perfect marriage. If you're looking at Heidi and I to be perfect, good grief, we got in a fight this morning and over something that was really dumb, okay? It happens. I stink at this. I'm not good at this. I need the gospel. I need Jesus to be transforming in my life for any of this to function. And so hear that. To kind of prompt us and get us rolling on this, I'd like you to turn to the book of Hosea. If you don't have a Bible, at the end of your rows, we have one there for you. We'd love for you to grab one of our Bibles. And Hosea's in the Old Testament. It's a prophetic book. In that Bible, it's on page 636. Hosea, we're going to be in chapter 1 and chapter 3, but let me kind of set the table here. What happens, this guy was a godly guy who loved God and wanted to be a difference maker, and he was a preacher. He was kind of did what I kind of do. Somebody was calling me Pastor Mike. I still don't like that, okay? I'm a little uncomfortable with, I'm just Mike, but I understand that I am the guy who's called to stand up here and talk to you guys, and you guys, for some reason, keep coming back every week and listening to me, which doesn't make sense to me either sometimes. But that is what I'm called to do, and this is what Hosea's calling was. He was a preacher, and he even probably began his ministry doing this as a single guy. And he was probably like most single people, man, God, when are you going to give me a wife? When are you going to give me a bride? When are you going to give me somebody that I can immerse my life in? And in this time where he's just trying to connect with God, God spoke into his life to marry a woman, but it's not what I would have expected or I even think he expected. Because it became a point of unbelievable pain and anguish in the life of Hosea. And what happens in this passage, we're going to walk through it and show you what goes on in this passage and use it to kind of set up our discussion about these issues. What happens in the life of Hosea is that he ends up in this relationship that leaves him empty and broken, but it becomes a great image for us to see. Because it becomes an image of how God wrestles and hurts and grieves over the fact that his people, those who trust him, constantly find ways to leave him and cheat on him. And Hosea's marriage becomes this image of this. Okay? So, Hosea chapter 1, look at verse 2. It says, when the Lord first spoke through Hosea, the Lord said to Hosea, the first thing God really spoke into his life was this. Go take to yourself a wife of whoredom. I like this translation of the Bible because it doesn't hold punches. Go find yourself a whore and make her your wife. Okay, I'll talk about that in a minute because there's some different ways to approach it. But go take for yourself a wife of whoredom and have children of whoredom, for the land commits great whoredom by forsaking the Lord. So he went and took Gomer, the daughter of Diblaim, and she conceived and bore him a son. All right, first of all, why would you marry any woman named Gomer? I mean, you know, I'm thinking USMC, you know, well, golly, you know, I mean, you know. But he finds this woman named Gomer, and it says she is a wife of whoredom, and they have children of whoredom, which basically, you know, the idea is that this woman on some level has some really bad morals. There's two approaches to this, and I'm not really sure which one's right. One is that this from day one, this chick was easy. She would sleep around, and she turned tricks. She was a prostitute. She had a pimp, all that stuff, okay? Or the other approach is that God is speaking into his life, but he's kind of looking back on it as he's writing, realizing that God had led him to this woman who probably already had a questionable reputation, but she wasn't a hooker yet. But that through their relationship, the seeds that had been sown into her life of being kind of loose and easy kept coming out. And this became just kind of what happened in their home. I'm not sure which is right. I think it's the second. I think it's not that God said, go find a hooker and marry her. I think what God is saying is God led her to a specific woman, but he already knew that that woman probably had a past and a reputation. But he loved her and immersed himself in her and called her to himself and made this woman who really nobody else would marry. Nobody else would deal with. I mean, for guys, there's two types of women, the women that they would marry and the women that they would sleep with. And a lot of girls think if they'll become this woman, they'll get a guy to make this woman. It doesn't work that way. Guys, men are pigs. Men in the world, there's two types of women, the women they'll marry and the women they'll sleep with. And she's the woman, this is one of the women that men would sleep with, nobody's going to marry, but Hosea makes this woman his wife. Now here's what's going on. In this whole story, I want to be Homer. Hosea. I want to be Homer, like Simpson. I want to be Hosea. But in the whole story, God wants me to understand, I am not, I am Gomer. I am the one that in spite of me, I don't deserve his grace. God called me to himself and made me his own. And that's what's going on. But then something terrible happens. Flip over to chapter 3. Chapter 3, it says, and the Lord said to me, go again, love a woman who is loved by another man and is an adulteress. It's actually the same basic idea, who is a harlot, a hooker, a prostitute. Even as the Lord loves the children of Israel, though they turn to other gods and love raisin, cakes of raisin. Now, the cakes of raisin is kind of a weird thing because you're like, what's the big deal about, you know, I like raisins. Is there a problem with this? Eating raisin cakes was part of cultic idolatry. Other nations used raisin cakes. They saw them as an aphrodisiac, okay? And they would use raisin cakes as a way to worship in temple prostitution. They were leaving God. It's not that they were eating raisin cakes. It's that they were involved. God's people were worshiping idols and giving themselves to other gods in horrible rituals. And they were totally turning their back on the God who called them to himself in the same way that Gomer had done. And he says, so I bought her for 15 shekels of silver and a homer of and a lectek of barley. All right, so here's what goes on. They were married. They had three children, chapter 1 teaches us. But somewhere in this, Gomer had gotten herself in situations where she started cheating on him. And that cheating on Hosea turned into being really easy, to being ashamed, to being totally, I can't even look him in the eye, to finally she leaves the home out of this brokenness, and eventually she gets to the point where the only way she can survive is to start turning tricks. So she's out in the street, she's turning tricks, she's found a pimp. It says another man loved her, it's meaning that another man was having sex with her, okay? And she is turning tricks, she's got a pimp, she's got somebody she is now enslaved to in her prostitution. And the Bible says here that Hosea, in trying to live out the Christian life, to love Jesus, to love God, God speaks to him and says, go find her again. And not marry her this time. Go, I love it, love a woman who's being loved by another man. Oh my gosh, can you imagine this? And Hosea goes out, he searches the streets, he does everything he can to find her, and he finds Gomer, he finds her pimp master, and he pays the dude off. And here's what's amazing. He says he paid him a certain amount of silver and a certain amount of barley. Every commentary I read said what's being implied here is that Hosea basically broke the piggy bank and took his life savings, and it still wasn't enough. And he had to then to go to his barns and take his leftover food for the rest of the year. He put those two things together, went and found her pimp, and bought her back. Holy cow! How does a marriage get to this point? But the beauty of it is that God goes on. Look at this. In chapter 3, he says, verse 3, he says, I said to her, you must dwell as mine for many days. You shall not play the whore or belong to another man, and so will I also be with you. For the children of Israel shall dwell many days without a king or prince, without sacrifice or pillar, without ephod or household gods. Afterward, the children of Israel shall return and seek the Lord their God and David their king, and they shall come in fear of the Lord and his goodness of the latter days. This is what he says. Listen, we're going to come home, and you're going to live in my house as my wife, but there's going to be a period of time where we don't touch each other and you're not touching anybody. Because you have got to work through your shame and come to a point where you are broken before we can really go forward on with a physical relationship. I do not just want to be another dude for you. And so I'm going to forego for a guy what is very important in a relationship until you come to a point of healing. And God says, my people are doing the same thing. And I'm going to put them in a position, and God brings judgment. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail about that, but God brings judgment on them where he basically takes them out of their land and puts them in a situation where they are alone with God with no other options. And until healing comes, he doesn't bring them back to their homes or houses. And God says, I'm going to do the same thing because I love my bride. I love my people too. And this is what he does with us as people of God when we fail, okay? But this story, wow, man, what a picture of brokenness and how marriages, I've heard so many stories. I heard a story just last week of a guy who's a pastor in Central Missouri who had to resign his church because he was making inappropriate comments to his secretary. I've told you that one of my best friends is going through something that's brutal, and we still cannot put it together how it could have ever gotten to the point that it got to. How do you deal with that? And this morning, I've got some plans and I've got some stuff here. And I just kind of want to walk through some issues that I think are important, because I want you to realize that as we go through these things, marriage is always an image and a path to something so much greater. It is always something that points us to the gospel. It points us to Jesus, but it also pictures our relationship with Christ. We see it even in this passage, how Jesus uses this, or God uses this analogy of Hosea and Gomer is a picture of his love for his people. And so marriage is like that. But there's some real issues that we can run into that become very dangerous and big struggles in marriage that can lead to the things that happen in this passage. How do you ever get to that point? And what I want to do is try to speak some things about the gospel into your lives this morning so that if you're married, you'll already begin to structure your marriage to be aware of these things and to fight for the good things in your marriage. And if you're not, you will make sure that you begin to build even into your own character and your own life some of the things that are necessary so that when you do find God leads you to a spouse and you do find that person you're going to spend your life with, that you begin to cultivate some of these things in your life already, okay? And I love this quote from R.C. Sproul. He says, "The more we're able to reveal ourselves to our life partners and still be loved, the more we are able to understand what a relationship with God is all about." You know, marriage, here's the deal. I like to think I'm good at stuff, okay? I really like to feel, so I like to feel like, hey, marriage is such an image of the gospel. Because I realize that God has given me a person who loves me unconditionally, loves me deeply. But the more I do this, the more I'm with my wife, the more I realize that I am worse than I thought I was. And I am more loved than I ever thought I could be. Hey, do you ever experience that? I mean, especially if you've been married for a while, do you ever come to a point where you're like, dang, I really am not good at this. And when I was 22, I was terrible. And the more I go, the more, it's not that I'm realizing I'm getting good at this. It's the more I realize I'm not, and I need grace from my spouse and from God. But in the midst of that, the more I am with my wife and the closer I am to her, the more I realize that in spite of all my flaws, I'm still unconditionally loved. And that's the gospel. So as you hear this, don't make a list. As I kind of talk through these things, and I'm going to have to do them kind of quick, but as I talk through these things, don't start saying, well, I've got to work on this, this, and this. It all is to show us that we need to be aware of our failure, look to Jesus, and allow him to transform us. The first thing I want to kind of deal with this morning as we talk about this, and as I'm going to kind of show you these plans and wrestle with them and deal with them, is communication and conflict. Communication and conflict. You know, this plan over here is really not in good shape. Neither one of them are. And often as we talk about, you know, communicating, we're good at the fighting end of it, not so good at really dealing with relationships and making them grow. And I hope that your relationship isn't like a relationship that I read about at a place called the Blue Dolphin Inn in Southern California. This couple got married, they had the reception there. And in the middle of the reception, the husband and wife started arguing. They started shouting at each other and arguing. And the guy, being a man, went over and grabbed a gob of cake and said, "You better back off." And she didn't. Hit her right in the face with a big old gob of cake. Well, she got mad and bull rushed him and threw the whole cake towards him. And at this wedding reception, it turned into an all-out food fight between his family and her family. Woohoo! Yeah, that's awesome. I hope your marriage isn't like that. Conflict and communication is a big deal. And it's good to know how to fight fair and how to bring up things. Now, this will not be a seminar on this, but I do want you to answer this question, okay? Which are you more like? When you deal with conflict, which are you more like? Are you more like a firecracker? Now, if you have a worship folder, this is on your thing. I want you to circle the one that is like you, okay? Are you more like a firecracker? A stand-up night at the comedy club, a crock pot, or a submarine dive? See, probably you resemble one of these. You may be a firecracker, and every time you get in a conflict with your wife or your husband, man, you just go off. Fireworks, everything explodes, and man, you're just boom. That's me. Man, I'm quick with the comebacks, and they are big and bright, and everybody goes, ooh, ah, you know. That's my response. You might be stand-up night at the comedy club where for you, you know, all you do is you make jokes, and you tease, and you laugh, and you kind of put down your partner, and you kind of just, you know, say things that are hurtful, and you try to be funny, and you try to be comical and cynical, and you try to just say things that are going to get right to the heart, but you kind of be funny about it, okay? Or maybe you're a crock pot. Maybe over a period of weeks and weeks and weeks, you just keep things inside, but it's slowly getting hot. And gradually, as it's getting warmer and warmer, and finally, you've just hit a boiling point and you stew over. Or maybe you're a submarine dive. Maybe the way you deal with it is that you just never deal with it. Man, you go deep, you hide, you avoid, and you think by doing that you're pleasing your spouse and that you're solving problems because you're just keeping it inside. But what's really going on is you're building up resentment that is going to come out at some point in time, and you're not going to know how to deal with it. And all of a sudden, these things begin to be things that tear down and hurt your relationship. And man, these plants are kind of an image of maybe what our marriage might look like. And what happens is all of a sudden there's a lot of brokenness and a lot of tearing down and just a lot of hurt and pain that goes on with this. And there's a couple ways that this might come out, a couple dangers. Sometimes really shallow communication. The fact that a husband and wife can't talk about anything that is deeper than just superficial issues becomes a very hurtful thing because one or maybe both are longing for something deeper, but it just never goes there. Another danger is hurtful communication, when people say things that are just, man, they cut right to the heart, and your words are cutting, or you pull in heavy artillery right at once. Man, you're just blowing things up, and you say things, you know, you're bringing in stuff that happened when, you know, in your first year of marriage, and you're talking about somebody's mama, and you're talking about your daddy this, and all of a sudden, you're just bringing in all kinds of issues. And all of a sudden, the communication and the way you deal with conflict and the way you love on one another with your words becomes a big issue. Now, what I'm not going to do is I'm not going to tell you, hey, here's five things you need to do to communicate right, because there's no such thing. No formula for this. But the Bible does have some very good things to say to us that instead of cutting and hurting might nurture. For example, look at this passage. In Matthew chapter 7, verses 3 through 5, he says when you see the speck in your brother's eye, why do you see the speck that is in your brother's eye, but do not notice the log that is in your own eye? How can you say to your brother, let me take the speck out of your eye, when there is a log in your own eye? You hypocrite, first take the log out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to take the speck out of your brother's eye. Here's what I get from this. Every time I want to attack my wife and blow up like a firecracker because that's who I am, I'm lousy. I need to realize that I need grace a lot more than she does. And so if I need it so bad, I need to be willing to give it to her instead of blow up, right? Now, do I do that? No, I don't. Which is why I stink at this thing, okay? It's why I need grace. It's why I need the gospel. It's why I need Jesus. Marriage is there to remind me of that every day, that I am loved unconditionally in spite of my failures. But sometimes I need to stop and realize that. Another passage in Psalm 141, verse 3, it says, set a guard, O Lord, over my mouth and keep watch over the door of my lips. That's one I really need. I need somebody to set a guard over my mouth and keep watch over my lips, okay? And maybe that's your experience. And maybe you'll find that if God will do that in your life, it'll be kind of a watering, nurturing thing for the plant. And Proverbs 15:1 says, a soft answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. Harsh words just make people mad. Here's one. Ephesians chapter 4, verse 26 says, be angry and do not sin. Do not let the sun go down in your anger. Is anger a sin? No. But boy, it's a short step sometimes from being angry and sinning. But here's the thing that it says. It says, don't let the sun go down in your anger. I really think this is a good marriage principle. When there is conflict, it's important to deal with it before you go to bed. Now, sometimes that's hard because I told you mine. I hope my wife, I didn't ask her this, but I hope she's okay. She's a submarine dive person. She likes it. And so for her, the easiest thing to do if we have conflict is to go to bed, pull the covers up all the way over her head, turn, face the other wall, and sleep it off. Meanwhile, I've got, for me, it's 4th of July, and it's grand finale going off, and I have to deal with it. And sometimes I have to grab her and say, all right, listen, I'm going to calm down, but we are going to deal with this before we go to sleep. It's important. I even think Scripture is giving us a great image of the fact that in all these things, we need to find ways to be like Jesus and to realize we're not like Jesus at the same time, and be people who love one another with our words and communicate well and have a deep relationship. And when we are going off or diving or crockpot, whatever it is that you are, that you recognize that and you understand it is about Jesus. It's about the gospel. I don't deserve this. I can't do it. I trust Jesus to change me. And you take that into your marriage relationship and let him change your communication and conflict, the way you deal with it. Now, I just didn't give you a formula. I've been to a lot of marriage conferences where they said, all right, here's five ways to fix your marriage in communication. And you go do the five things, and it works for 2 weeks, and then 2 weeks later, you're fighting again, and you still don't feel deep and connected. And God has something that's better, but boy, it comes when he changes you, and you experience that change on this level. So communication and conflict is one big issue. Another area that is pretty significant is the area of setting boundaries for health. Over here is I'm kind of doing this. Both these plants, this one has all these weeds that have grown up, by the way, and they're just kind of choking this off. And, you know, a lot of things, we can let a lot of things in life do that. Both these plants are struggling to find. They're just kind of all over the place. Do you notice that? They're just kind of falling over, and, you know, they're just not very pretty and not very functional, and, you know. And the reason is because these plants actually need pretty strong boundaries. They need a stake. But often in our marriages, we're kind of the same way, is that we need something that will help us, as we understand really who we are, stay put together and strong and healthy. But Satan's really good at conning us. And this is the con. Men and women, both. I think we're both this way, okay? Here's the con. Satan tells us that we're really pretty good people, that we can do this and we'll be okay without really understanding our own nature. And the more I go into this, the more I realize that if I am left to myself, I am not going to make the right decision most of the time. If I don't help myself and set some boundaries when the computer is on and nobody else is around, I really want to look. If I'm not careful and set up some boundaries in my life, I can engage in conversations that may lead me in the wrong way with another woman. If I'm not careful and I don't really pay attention to the fact that I am a fallen person desperately in need of grace, I will put myself in situations like Ray did that are very dangerous. Boundaries, I'm not talking about being a legalist and you set up a bunch of rules for yourself. I'm talking about coming to grips with who we really are and how we struggle and set up some good, solid boundaries. And Job is talking, I love this passage. He says, I made a covenant with my eyes not to look with lust upon a young woman. Man, how do you make that covenant in this culture? Teenage guys, how do you make that covenant in this culture? Young ladies, how do you make that covenant when you love romance novels? How do you make that covenant in this culture? I don't know. It's hard. But man, Job was saying, I've set up some boundaries in my life. I think boundaries are a good thing. Let me tell you some of the ones that I have for myself that I would encourage you to think about. I may not do this well. We'll see how it goes. I'm going to try to weave this as I'm talking. But one boundary that I have is the boundary that I personally am never going to be alone with another woman. On any level. Sometimes that's hard. Some of us work in situations where that may not be 100% possible. But when I begin to nurture relationships one-on-one with another person of another gender, and I begin to, you know, kind of confide in her and be close to her, that can really create some tension for me. It can create some struggles. It can create a depth of relationship that could be harmful. My guess is most people who end up having affairs, if they come out of a background in a life where they really understood that that's not God's best for them, it probably began not with somebody going, hey, I'd really like to sleep with that woman. Hey, I'd really like to screw up my life and be with that guy. Hey, I think that guy's hot to trot, and boy, anything I could do to get him in bed. Hey, look at her. Most people, it begins with the fact that two people begin to engage in conversations. They begin to have this alone time, maybe because of something that was outside of their control. But that alone time all of a sudden begins to create situations where they're confiding in each other and sharing. And talking about stuff. And I'm just not going to do it. This is my deal, okay? I'm just telling you what I do. I'm uncomfortable when I'm in a situation where it's just me and one other woman. Even in, you know, an open setting, I feel uncomfortable with that. I also am very weirded out by this, okay? Maybe you're not like this. I am. If another woman on any level is into my personal space and kind of messing with my love language thing, okay? I'm a touch guy. I didn't go into a lot of detail about that because that's, you know, kind of weird, but I'm a touch guy, okay? And so I really get the willies when other women touch me. Now, I'm not talking about side-to-side hugs and being sweet. I'm talking about, like, the idea of getting a massage from anybody but my wife freaks me out. I have zero desire. I really don't even like going to get my hair cut because she is too close, okay? And I think it's important that that's probably a good thing in my life that I've kind of got this unstated boundary that I'm not going to allow another woman into my love language's space. That's a place for my wife and her alone, okay? You know, for me, another boundary that I've kind of set for myself is the boundary of discussing my marriage. I think it's very, very important that you don't get into a situation where you begin to discuss your marriage with people of the opposite gender. That you don't start talking about how their marriage is hurtful and their husband stinks or their wife is not the type of woman she ought to be, or that person's love life isn't all that it should be. Is it working? Am I getting it right? Does it look terrible? Hey, it looks better than that one over there, all right? Not the horticulturalist, okay? You get the image we're going for, though. Here, if I turn it that way, it looks a little better. There you go. I was doing it for myself, see? I thought about having Heidi come up here and do it, but I just felt like the effect of me working on him while it went might be good, and maybe not. Anyway, but the bottom line is, you know, these boundaries, the boundary of not talking with another woman about your, for me, a marriage, or ladies, talking to a guy, I think that's huge. I think that is the first step to adultery. You know, they start being alone, and then all of a sudden she starts confiding in him about her husband. Well, guys love to be respected, and so it's fun to her to think you are that guy when my husband's not being. And guys like to be loved, and all of a sudden there is this connection there that will go away after a year of adultery. I mean, when it's based on that, it's going to go away, but for that time... And the best way is to set up a little boundary, to create a standard. Another boundary, and then I'll move on, is she allowing my wife, and this is a big one in my life, all right, allowing my wife to be my accountability. I went to a bunch of Promise Keeper stuff and other things where they said, find a guy accountability partner. I don't have a problem with that. But really, the best thing is for my wife to be. She has absolute access to my computer. In fact, I have purposefully not learned how to check the history on a computer. You know what I'm saying? Purposefully not learned how to do that so I could know how to delete it. She has absolute access to my computer to be able to go and look at every website I've looked at so that if I do mess up, she can look at me and go, what the heck's up with this? And that, more than anything else in my life, because I know what it does to her heart when I do fail in some of this stuff, more than anything else, I love her so much, I don't want to hurt her. It has really changed me in that. I mean, I'm being for real and kind of gut honest with you, you know, because, dude, if you think I'm up here, I got the microphone, I've got it all figured out, you're mistaken, I don't. But she, in these areas, when I go on trips, I want her to say, hey, what'd you do? Where'd you go? Were you alone? Did you go with a guy or were you in? I want her to ask me those questions. She's become my accountability for that. There's a level of intimacy there that's a good thing. Anyway, that's mine. You may have to, but I am telling you, recognize you're fallen. We need a stake to be tied to, or we're just going to be all over the place as people who are sinful and struggle, and we need Jesus. All right, a last area and is the area of forgiveness. You know, in all this stuff, all of a sudden, it's not just that we speak the wrong language, but we get hurt. And in our hurt, we attack. And in our attacks, we start flirting with somebody else or we find love from somewhere else. And we just tear down and we destroy. And we submarine dive and we just won't deal with it. We won't have anything to do with the other person. And all of a sudden, there's this depth of unforgiveness there. Sometimes that unforgiveness comes from little bitty things here and there, boom, boom, boom. It's just like the stacked up huge row of all these little bitty things that I just haven't dealt with. Or sometimes it's the monster. It's Hosea and Gomer. And we don't forgive. And we end up with this. A weed-infested, torn-up, worthless plant. Now, here's my guess. I was going to ask, if you're married, which does your relationship more resemble? Neither's good this morning, but here's the deal. For most of it, it's probably somewhere between here and there. But if it does get to this, is there hope? And the answer is yes. But it's a process. It's a long process of working through forgiveness as an event, of me looking at my wife, or my wife looking at me, you looking at your husband, you looking at your wife and saying, listen, I choose to forgive you. Here's what Hosea did. Hosea's act of forgiveness was giving up all that he had, his savings, his storehouse of his grain, to go buy her back, look her in the eye and say, I am taking you home. But then there was a process of forgiveness where he said, listen, there's going to be a period of time where our relationship's got to work through these things. You've got to find reconciliation and hope before we really come back together in an event and a process. And we've got to find that in relationships as we work through. Forgiveness is a big deal. Ruth Graham, you probably know she died this week. I like this quote. Billy Graham's wife said this. A marriage is made up of two good forgivers. And see, that's when we begin to be people who, in our marriages, we understand we are fallen people. We need Jesus. My relationship with my spouse drives us back to that. And I begin to realize that I do need to set up some boundaries and have some things that hold me tight to things. And I begin to be a person who freely forgives for anything. Because I've been forgiven for so much. See, I think the reason Hosea was able to do this is Hosea understood that he needed more forgiveness from God than he would give to Gomer. And as he did that, it is an expression of Jesus in my life. Because I need to be forgiven. I need to forgive. I need grace. I need to be a giver of grace. I need to understand that I'm fallen. I also need to understand that Christ is changing me. That tension of the gospel, marriage is the greatest place to work all these things out. And so I hope in these areas you begin to, you may be over here and you may feel like, man, this really is, we're just a weed-infested little cut-up family right now. There's hope, but it's after me tearing this thing up this morning, it's going to take time for this to become what it's supposed to be. It'll take us 5 minutes for Heidi to go home and rewind that for it to be what it's supposed to be, but it'll take time for this to be what it's supposed to be. But there is great value. I love this story. I'm going to close with a story this morning about an 8-cow wife. In the Caribbean, this American went there, and he began to ask, you know, I need to find out about this. And they would say, go to, I got to look at this guy's name, Johnny Lingo. You need to go find Johnny Lingo. And they would say, well, I need to find out about this. Oh, Johnny Lingo is the guy to talk to. But every time, it kind of became apparent that Johnny Lingo was the guy on the island that everybody went to when they had issues and problems. He was kind of a wealthy guy, and he kind of was a jack of all trades and kind of knew how to do everything. But every time somebody would talk about Johnny Lingo, they'd kind of snicker. And they'd snicker because they'd say, well, Johnny Lingo's a pretty smart guy, but there's one thing I don't understand, man. He gave 8 cows for his wife. And the guy's like, what are you talking about? And so one guy finally explained it to him. He said, man, when in our culture, when you want a wife, you have to go buy that wife from her dad, okay? And the way you buy that wife from her dad is usually cows are the best, thing to give away. How would you like that, ladies? Hey, 3 cows is what I was worth, but that's how they would do it. And, a kind of a homely wife would be a 1-cow wife. If you just, you were kind of a dorky looking dude and that's the best you could do, 1 cow would do. 2-cow wife was okay. 5-cow wife, man, she was, the hot model, gorgeous, had doctorate degree. I mean, this is a 5-cow wife. Well, Johnny Lingo gave 8 cows for his wife. But everybody said, it's the dumbest. He got taken. He just absolutely got snookered because at best, I mean, she's kind of homely. She kind of had a hump in her back and kind of had this weird look about her, you know, had an eye thing going. And she was at best a two-cow wife, at best. That's probably too much. He gave 8 cows for her. So this guy went, I've got to find this out. And so he went and found this Johnny Lingo guy. Went to his house and began to talk to him. He said, you got to explain this to me. And he said, listen, I wanted everybody on this island to know that I gave 8 cows for my wife. I want everybody to realize the value that I place in her and how much she means to me. And as they were sitting there talking, this woman walks out of the kitchen and she is a bombshell. Gorgeous. Beautiful. The guy said it's the most beautiful woman I ever saw. He thought, well, he's got some other, you know, woman working in the home for him. And he turned and introduced him to his wife. He said, this is my wife. And he thought, he said, I don't get this. And here's the real truth of the matter. She began to believe she was an 8-cow wife because he had invested his life into giving and being the type of guy and the type of husband and loving her and making her feel valued. And that transformed her. And here's what I want you to hear. In this story, we are not Hosea, we are Gomer. But Christ came. God sent his son and placed more value in you and I than we could ever hope for, than we're ever worth. I am worse than I ever thought I could be and more loved than I could ever imagine. And in the midst of that is the transforming power of the gospel and grace that changes us. So guys, love your wife like she's an 8-cow wife, but live as if God gave his only son for us. I'm going to pray and we're going to worship. And I just pray that your heart will be moved by this and remember the imagery that we had this morning. Jesus, we love you. We praise you and honor you. I thank you for our chance to be here this morning. Lord, I pray that you will help us to understand how to live lives of forgiveness and boundaries, and even in our conflict and failures to do that, you will help us to realize we need you. But most of all, Lord, help us to look to you for hope and the answers to life. Thank you for the gospel and for Jesus. In your name I pray. Amen.